This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Thursday, I'll be talking with film director Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick. Together, they have produced a 10-part television series and a 700-page book called The Untold History of the United States. That's Thursday, January 17th at 9:30 a.m. A talk with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick on KBOO, your radio station.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Eric Cascade is off today. Instead, we'll hear an interview about violence against women and how the stigmatization of victims persists across. At 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman interviews Dr. Gary Weiner, naturopathic physician and founder of Pearl Natural Health, about natural approaches to improving immunity during the flu season. And at 11:30, the guest is G. Randy Kasten, author of Just Trust Me, Finding Truth in a World of Spin. Kasten, a civil litigation attorney, shares strategies for critical thinking and fact-finding. Thanks, KBOO listeners, and thanks, members, for your support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Violence against women is a pervasive problem in virtually all cultures, though the forms it takes vary greatly. News reports around the world recounted the savage gang rape in December of a young Indian woman who later died of her injuries, and the resultant outrage and demand for justice it provoked inside India. Ongoing mass rapes in the Democratic Republic of Congo and an epidemic of rape in post-earthquake Haiti are also in the news, perhaps obscuring the fact that gender violence, including domestic and dating violence, sexual slavery, and forced prostitution, also occur daily in the United States. One recent publicized example is the rape of a young woman by members of the Steubenville, Pennsylvania high school football team. In 2012, Congress failed to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act, originally passed in 1994, when the House version could not be reconciled with the more expansive version approved by the U.S. Senate. Washington State Senior Democratic Senator Patty Murray plans to reintroduce the legislation in the 113th Congress that was sworn in on January 3rd. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Hillary Haldane, an assistant professor of anthropology at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut and co-editor of the 2011 anthology Anthropology on the Front Lines of Gender-Based Violence, Stories from Around the World, written by activists working in women's shelters and anti-violence organizations and outreach groups. Here she puts violence against women in cultural context and describes some of the methods being used to combat it.
One of the things as anthropologists we really try to tease out is, are we just hearing more about it because of these various responses and institutions and laws that's in place, or is it that violence is actually increasing? And that is something that is very empirically difficult to test and really ground scientifically. So we try to treat it as, look, we know that it's a problem. We know that it is extensive. We know that many, many, many women, children, and some men are experiencing this. So what's the best way to respond in a local context, knowing it's a global problem?
You know, in America, we hear about these really horrific cases of violence against women, like in India or Afghanistan, and we say, you know, that's over there, not over here. What similarities and differences do you see in this violence that takes place around the world?
Well, what I see as similar is that what we do tend to find cross-culturally, unfortunately, is this response that does blame the victim. There really is very few places that you find an active stigmatization of the perpetration itself. And I think we can just look at the recent case in Ohio where we're trying to save this football team, or Penn State, where we want to save the football team and the dignity of the football team over acknowledging the experiences of the victims and survivors of these crimes. So I think that one of the unfortunate things we do find cross-culturally is the stigmatization of the victim, and that's an interesting dynamic that the response isn't to protect the vulnerable. The response seems to be to blame the vulnerable for what's happened to them. Now, obviously, in different cultures, the forms of violence and how people think about the violence and maybe what forms of violence are acceptable and are not acceptable, that's obviously cross-culturally variable. So there are forms of violence that we might consider violence as Americans that happen in other cultural contexts.
Can you give any examples of violence against women that might be acceptable in some cultures but not in others?
Within anything that we consider a culture, so we might talk about American culture or Indian culture or Samoan culture, there's obviously heterogeneity and differences of opinion. So even within American culture, there are some families who absolutely believe they should be able to spank their children, and there are other Americans who feel that it's not appropriate. There's diversity of opinions within everything that we draw a circle around as a culture. So obviously, in some places, some people think it's absolutely okay to strike their wife if their wife has maybe been unfaithful or done something that is disapproving. There's people in all cultures who believe that they can do things to women that other people within that culture consider unacceptable. So I think it's really important to be careful to acknowledge that there is no widespread homogenous opinion that, say, slapping a woman in a certain culture is acceptable, or, you know, hitting a child in a culture is acceptable.
Hillary Haldane, based on what you just said, that in all cultures there are those who think it's not okay to abuse women and that there are more avenues for women to report abuse, do you see any specific way forward in trying to reduce the violence? Is it more laws? Is it more education? Is it more emphasis on the role of men and trying to persuade them not to do it, or what?
I think you've hit on two things there, and it's the latter statement you said about how we address men. I think men absolutely have to be made aware that violence is not okay. Please do not make the connection that I'm blaming video games for any type of male violence in our society. But we have so much celebration of inaction of violence through games, through play, through kind of stories that we tell, through the language that we use, even in our own culture, that we instill in the sense of masculinity something that is very much about being powerful and dominant of others. And I think men absolutely have to be a part of the solution. They're 90% of the problem. So we're not going to eradicate violence against women if we don't eradicate the ideas that men cross-culturally hold about power and domination. I think that may sound feminist and cliche, but I think it's absolutely true. But the second part is about reaching out to women and letting them know that it's not acceptable for them to be treated this way and that they have rights. And those rights extend from just everything from economic. So in some places, women do not have economic control. They don't have ownership of land. They don't inherit things at the same rates as men. They don't have leadership roles. And there are cultural and institutional barriers to having women achieve full equality. Look how hard it's been for us to even get 20 women in the Senate to be in decision-making power. So I think that it's a two-pronged approach. You have to both have full economic and institutional empowerment of women, and you have to change how we think about masculinity and the relationships between men and women. And if we don't do those things cross-culturally, this problem is just going to continue to persist.
That was Hillary Haldane, an anthropologist at Quinnipiac University and co-editor of Anthropology at the Front Lines of Gender-Based Violence. Find more perspectives on confronting violence against women on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Dog Noir, investigative reporter. In 1989, a worldwide ban on ivory trade was approved by the United Nations Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna, an international agreement between governments, which provides varying levels of protection for species that are or may be in danger of extinction from international trade. Levels of poaching fell dramatically and black market prices of ivory slumped. But now, poaching is at a peak. Most of the ivory smuggling containers leave the African continent through Indian Ocean seaports in East African countries, primarily Kenya and the United Republic of Tanzania. China and Thailand are the two primary destinations for illegal ivory consignments. Seizures of large ivory consignments in Malaysia, the Philippines, and Vietnam since 2009 were believed to be in transit to China and Thailand. Only a few weeks ago, 4 tons of ivory were confiscated by Hong Kong authorities, thanks to a tip from Chinese authorities alerting officials to 2 shipping containers whose cargo was disguised as plastic scrap. The illegal ivory was worth $26.7 million in Hong Kong currency. While governments and conservationists move towards a protection of elephants, the affluence of Asian countries and the poverty of Africa make smuggling a lucrative business. Run by gangs with high-powered guns, there is little punishment for poaching, but Interpol and the International Fund for Animal Welfare have teamed up to go after the criminals. The losers, of course, are the elephants. Only some Asian male elephants have tusks, but all African elephants, including females, have tusks. In 1979, there were an estimated 1.3 million African elephants. Poaching has reduced that figure by half. Only 600,000 African elephants remain. Dog Noir is archived at kpfk.org. Click on Audio Archives and the program Dog Noir. Information and links can also be found at dognoir.com. Thanks to Mark Maxwell, Matt Perez, and Roy of Hollywood. For KPFK and Dog Noir, I'm Janie Taylor.
KABU is proud to be a media sponsor of An Evening with Dr. Michelle Alexander, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street. Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. There will be a community fair, community panel, and Michelle will read from her book. For more info, go to kboo.fm.
Into a world I plunge, through my headphones, escaping to the streetlight. I begin to believe in destiny when my...
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. This morning we're going to talk about something that you may have only a very vague idea of, nanoparticles. On the surface, nanoparticles seem to offer many potential benefits. By adding them to foods and food packaging, they can help to deliver nutrients, act as thickening agents, enhance taste or flavor, or ensure longer freshness. But because of their submicroscopic size, these minute versions of silver, zinc, titanium oxide, and other metals may also cause adverse health impacts. Yet industry is forging ahead, introducing nanoparticles into a wide array of packaged foods and food packaging. This morning, we'll talk about what nanoparticles are and how you may unwittingly be ingesting them, with my guest Britta Belli, whose recent article Eating Nano in the E in the Environmental Magazine explores what we know and don't know about the impacts of proliferating nanoparticles in our food supply. Britta is the editor of E Magazine. Welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
See, do we have Britta on the line here? Hi, Britta. Welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Okay, I'm glad to have you back. Well, I want to start by talking about what nanoparticles are. I thought I knew what they were actually until I did a little more research yesterday and realized they've been around a lot longer than I realized. So how do we define nanoparticles?
Right, so these are microscopic particles. They're tens of thousands of times smaller than the width of a human hair. It really has to do with the small size. And this is what differentiates them. And the reason that they could be a potential, health problem for us is that they can do things in the body because of their small size that larger particles can't.
Now, how are they something that's created, or do they occur naturally in the environment?
These are man-made. These are made in a lab. They're put into a kind of like dust form, and that's how they're added to products. And during that process, it has to be very tightly controlled, and workers who handle these particles have to be very careful. And there's lots of kind of things in place to prevent them from, say, inhaling these particles. Because of this tiny size, they can travel and present, hazards for. They can be so easily inhaled, and so they are man-made.